Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. Today I talk with Nico Laminen. Nico is the founder of Consensus Network, a company that focuses on localizing and distributing important literature about Bitcoin, Austrian economics, and sovereignty. Nico recognized the importance of being able to convey the Bitcoin message into other languages, starting with the Finnish edition of the Bitcoin Standard, which he and a small group of volunteers translated themselves. Since then, the company has published over 60 books in dozens of languages. We talk about the Consensus Network's mission and the way they operate as a decentralized organization, and at a higher level, explore the idea of how a small group can affect powerful change. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you would like to support the show, please consider streaming some Satoshis via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform such as Fountain or Breeze. Otherwise, on to the show. So we'll find a good spot to cut in, Nico, but we'll just, you know, get the juices flowing. It's been an early start for me here in New Zealand. So what time is it where you are?
It's 9 p.m. for me.
Yeah, it's always the case. When I chat with my friends in the UK or Europe, it's sort of like, yeah, I've got to get up really early, but no problem. It's all in the name of Bitcoin and the great journey that we're all on, so I don't mind it. And it's quite nice in the morning, just coming into autumn. But hey, I appreciate you making the time.
For sure.
Yeah, a friend of mine actually recommended to get in touch when I was in Tokyo recently, and we caught up with a few Bitcoiners, and one Bitcoiner in particular whose book got translated into French, I believe, via the Consensus Network, Jimmy Song. And I was really curious about this project, and my friend recommended to reach out to you. So Consensus Network, I dived into it, really fascinating. Can you tell me a little bit, please, about what it is, where it came from, and I guess what your mission is, if that's all right, please?
Yeah, for sure. I guess we have to go a little bit meta on this to help you understand like how something like this, like, let's start with, like, you wouldn't think translating French literature would be something that is worth, I mean, maybe it's worth doing, but it's certainly not profitable, and it's not really, but it's doable. And the reason why it's doable is what I call the starfish organizational model. And this is not by any means my invention. It comes from the book called The Starfish and Spider, The Unstoppable Power of Leaderless Organizations, which was incidentally written 1 year before a Bitcoin white paper came out, so 2008. And I read it after understanding Bitcoin at a little bit of a deeper level. So it immediately resonated with me. Starfish organizations, to put it in a nutshell, are ideologically driven collectives of like-minded people with similar goals. And you were talking about the mission there, and the mission here that I guess we're both on the same road is the propagating the Bitcoin education and information. And to be able to do that, like if you go the so-called fiat road, the road better known, you would have to hire a bunch of translators. You would have to spend a lot of money upfront, just to be able to get the work translated and then published. And it's quite capital intensive, and it's unless you're loaded, it's not really something that you can do, and, you know, which I'm not. So I had to come up with a different way to doing it. And it actually didn't start as such an ambitious project as it is now. Once I read Bitcoin Standard, I just wanted to, for my dad and for other people who are not so good at English, to be able to read it in my language, which is Finnish. So 6 million people in the world speak that language, not really, you know, super excited, except for me and for other Bitcoiners from Finland. So then I realized something, that this same phenomena exists in every single country. there's these people like me and the people who've been working on these translations who want exactly the same thing, to give this information to their friends and families and close ones. And that's the reward. Like, that's, there's no payment involved, upfront payment involved in that. They don't do it because they are maybe professional translators who want to get paid for their time. They want this knowledge to be available to as many people as possible that they care about. So that's the basis of a Starfish model. And to go a little bit deeper in that is, like, if you read the book Starfish and Spider, there's this, my favorite example is the Amazonian Indians who had these Nantans, who are kind of like tribal chiefs. They were not elected. They simply did what they thought was the best course of action at any given moment. And then they had people joining in them and supporting them and forming these small tribes. And this is a perfect metaphor for Bitcoiners, in my opinion. Bitcoiners are the quintessential Starfish organization because we are driven by the same goals. We have leadership, we have thought leaders, whatever you want to call them, but the people who people choose to follow them. Nobody has to follow them. So the same thing, this is what made the Amazonian Indians very resilient against centralized attacks, because the attackers were used to, like, you go to a country, you cut off the head of the king of the tribe, and then you reap the spoils. That didn't work with the Nantans, because then, you know, if you would kill one chief, another would rise up, because they are still on the mission. It's not a person-driven mission. It's not dictated from top down. It grows from the ground up. Yeah. And that's kind of like what started happening with Consensus. And we started in 2019 with just the Finnish translation of Bitcoin Standard, and then expanded to other languages gradually. Now we have over 60 books across dozens of languages within a matter of 5 years.
Yeah,
and it's all organic growth.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting. And there's a couple of things there. You talk about the high barrier to entry with traditional translation, and I can appreciate that. I've done a couple of books myself, more photo-based photo books and creative work. But looking at how the traditional sort of way you would do that with publishing would work, and then how it would work doing it yourself, I just, you know, there's no chance, you know, especially when you've kind of got a smaller audience, as you say. We sort of live in this hyper-capitalist world where, you know, only the biggest fish can sort of survive through the way it is set up. And so there's not room for that sort of smaller enterprise. And so trying to do it yourself through kind of crowdfunding, and you see an emergence right now of like Bitcoin crowdfunding platforms, which is really exciting. But, you know, looking at those as ways of sort of decentralizing information propagation is really interesting. And it's also interesting talking about you talk about being ideologically driven, and in a way there's almost this reluctance from Bitcoiners, well, certainly from myself, but it's almost like a responsibility that I certainly feel to do what I'm doing with this show and with other projects. I do it because I feel that I need to do it. And I do you sort of know what I mean about that? It's like you need to utilize your skill set, whatever it may be, for yourself. You know, you started this project, the Finnish English connection. For me, you know, working with podcasting, creative work, utilizing that skill actually to develop Bitcoin in my own way, just as everyone else has their own skill set. I feel a real drive to do that, which I haven't felt as much for other things previously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't say that it's not really a responsibility, because I don't feel like I have to do it. I don't have to do it. And to be honest, from time to time, I think, like, you know, maybe I should go back to construction. I'm a construction engineer by trade. And I can make way more money doing that. Or I could do, you know, shit coins or whatever. There's plenty of options that are more lucrative financially in the fiat world, certainly. But I guess this is where the responsibility comes in, because there's something that I like to talk about, which is threefold kind of like capital that is not financial capital, which is reputational, skill, and legacy. And these are the profits that I seek. So I seek reputational capital, I seek skill capital, I seek legacy capital. So what I want to What drives me every day out of the bed is the thought that my great grandchildren will live in a better world. And that's, I guess, what you referred as a responsibility. It's kind of that, but it's also purely selfish, because that's the reward. Like, I like to tell myself that this is the reward that I get from this, and it's worth it. And no matter how many different opportunities may come, I just always circle back to utilizing the specific skill set that I have to do the highest impact work that is available at the moment. And for me, it's book publishing right now. So
Yeah.
it's just there's no option. There's no second best.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the word responsibility is has a bit of nuance to it, but absolutely what you refer to. And those are Austrian economics ideas, aren't they? Those other capitals. Because you also publish, you talk about Bitcoin, you publish Bitcoin work, but you're also interested in Austrian economics and self-sovereignty as well, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like we sort of profile as the Bitcoin publishing house, but that's not the full story. Like, we just published a book called Praxeology by Knut Swanholm. And I'm like, that's I would say it was even more important rabbit hole for me to dwell in was the Austrian economics rabbit hole. Rothbard, Mises, and all these great Austrian thinkers and praxeological thinkers. And Bitcoin just is such a shoe in for that kind of thinking. So it's much more fundamental. It goes way deeper than just simply Bitcoin, the technology, or Bitcoin, the social phenomena, or Bitcoin, the money even. It's the whole like time preference thinking. My time preference, like for 30 years of my life, I lived a high time preference life, and now suddenly it completely shifted. I'm thinking in thousands of years instead of, months.
Yeah.
So and this is something that I've heard other Bitcoiners also who delve into the Austrian rabbit hole and the praxeological rabbit hole. When you start thinking about really fundamentally what drives us, what drives human action, and that's always a selfish need to alleviate felt uneasiness, and that's what Mises brings out. That's his the foundation of his thesis.
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
while we do maybe feel this kind of like responsibility, since we have this knowledge to share it, it is still a selfish act to do that, because we get something out of it. That's just beautiful and brilliant.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, there's two books that I read before I got into Bitcoin. I'm a relatively recent entrant, but I was deeply interested in Austrian economics for many years. And I was living in Japan at the time, and just learning about how that all works. Getting into the Mises Institute and sort of learning about this alternative system. And it's like once you've got an alternative viewpoint from which to stand upon, you can look at the incumbent system a lot more easily instead of just being within it and sort of accepting it as is. And then the other one was getting into Ayn Rand and objectivism. And as a creative person, my background is photography, and I do a lot of writing, creative writing, and design type stuff. It's really fascinating. And everyone talks about Atlas Shrugged, but I'm actually more of a fountainhead kind of a guy, and I love the story of that kind of devotion to it, to the self, to the idea of what you are capable of, and this kind of rejection of this mechanization of humans into just worker units, just sort of recognizing that everyone has the ability within them to achieve excellence and to change the world. And I think within that, that's merging those together was how I was able to bridge my creative work, which on the outside doesn't really, I'm not taking photos of Bitcoins, you know what I mean? But I'm taking photos of architecture, I'm taking photos of the world, I'm creating, work, and I'm always working on it through the lens of, well, what is this going to look like in 100 years? How are people going to look back on this period of time, this period of change, perhaps through my images, if they're able to, survive through that period. and actually sort of look back and make judgments on, you know, the early 21st century, and starting to think in that sort of more geologic timeframes, which in the fiat system you don't think like that. You're always about the next paycheck and about right now.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you know, I don't like labels that much. Like people call like, oh, you're a Bitcoin maximalist or a freedom maximalist, even like freedom maximalist, a little bit more leeway. But I guess what you just said there is like proof of work maximalism, like something that clearly has taken work. Like if you take an example, like gold standard era art, it is immediately evident to even a layman that amount of work has been put into the piece of art. It's less evident in the modern world where art can constitute anything, basically a line on a canvas or a banana taped to the wall that can constitute as art.
Yeah.
But the proof of work is not evident there. So yeah, I guess like you saying that you take photos of architecture, I applaud that. I love architecture. I love the proof of work era architecture and you know, building something that lasts and something that outlasts yourself. Like, for example, like in Barcelona, there's this Sagrada Familia, which is still under construction Gaudi. After 200 years. I mean, yeah. that's something that, you know, something for future, not just for your immediate satisfaction. Like it breaks my heart as a construction engineer that, for example, in Finland, they actually design buildings for 50 years and then they're going to be torn down. Like they kind of like, you know, buy themselves out of the responsibility by just say like, oh, this is just for 50 years because it just makes sense right now. And of course, you know, it tracks back to the bad money because people have to save in apartments and real estate. So then the whole incentive model is skewed. But yeah, that's another story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I appreciate that. Same here with New Zealand. You look at the older houses and they are rock solid. And then you look at the newer builds and they leak and they rot away. But it's yeah, very fascinating. And I agree with you, Gaudi and in Barcelona, the vision for that, you know, the structure and for building something over hundreds of years, it's just not possible in the fiat system. And in fact, we can't even do 5-year projects here anymore in New Zealand. We can't build roads. We can't build highways. It seems like we're, you know, we're accelerating towards this decay in a lot of, especially in the West, but in a lot of countries, you know, sort of the high of fiat has worn off. And now we've got, yeah, certainly in this country, you know, potholes in all of the roads, everything's falling apart. All of the infrastructure was built 105 years ago. And it's like, what's going wrong, you know, and it's hard to sort of zoom out. And I realize, you know, those questions about what is money, you know, what is the economy, these kind of fundamental kind of ideas and questions, it's actually really hard for people to even access the question, let alone the answer. It's like, how do you set that up in an accessible way? I think books like The Bitcoin Standard really help with that, but it's still something you have to decide to sit down and read. It's not a mode of thinking that's normal, or you know, it's not taught to be that critical of systems within society, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, it's true. Like, you know, we are selling books at the moment for Bitcoiners who want to orange pill other people. I mean, that's where we stand. Regular people who subscribe to the way things are or they used to be, they're nowhere near purchasing the books or even grabbing one. Even if they get gifted one, is most likely going to sit in the shelf a couple of years at least. However, there is value to that because at least the book exists in their library, hopefully, if people make those donations and gifts. And then when the time is ripe for each individual, they can reach out and grab and learn about the Bitcoin. But it's tough. Like we shouldn't be pushy and we shouldn't be hasty in this. People will need a lot of time to adjust to these ideas, and that's, yeah, I think that's a major reason why I'm building a library that will outlive me, because I'm not going to be here helping the people once they are ready, I think.
Yeah,
but the books might.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any thoughts, Nico, on sort of how something as revolutionary as Bitcoin rolls out? Like, when was the last time this happened? Was it the internet? Like, was it personal computing? Like, do we have a model for what change looks like and how that adoption curve might play out? You know, you've got the classic early adopters, late adopters, or late majority, the kind of the adoption curve. But what do you think that might look like for something as powerful as money?
It's really difficult to say. Like, we're talking about the first absolutely scarce digital asset that has not existed for, before 2009. So, I mean, I guess we are, if you've read the book, Sovereign Individual, which makes quite a nice case of how we move through these ages. Like, we are now in the information age that arguably started somewhere around the Berlin Wall falling down in 84, I believe, when things and news started being broadcasted at the speed of light globally. So it is very, very difficult, almost impossible for us to foresee what kind of curve or a hockey stick we're looking at with the development. Like, look at AI, for example, like AI-driven graphics design. I'm sure as a photographer, you've been looking at what's going on there, like how fast it's moving. And there's this concept of death by development in the sovereign individual. Let's say that you have a time machine and you bring a person from the Roman Empire to the day. Today, they might be so shocked that they don't recognize anything from their former life that it's just going to die. So it might be that physically we are still those monkey animals, but mentally we have reached like this with through technological and social evolution, we've reached a point where we can utilize tools in such efficiency that we can surpass our physical evolution. So I think like 50 years from now, maybe like if we have a time machine and you and I went 50 years forward, we might experience death by development because there's just simply no way to know.
Yeah, I guess the other interesting thing is the Bitcoin world, whether we like it or not, is predominated by English-based media. And if you look at the study of, a lot of study of postmodernism, philosophy, things like German and French literature have a lot to say in those regards. Europe in general has been a real hotbed of thought. Over the last couple of hundred years. And looking at Bitcoin thought in particular, is there an opportunity for authors? I mean, I expect probably today a lot of people are, able to speak English and who are thinking and operating in this space, but is there room for I guess, work to emerge in other languages and then also come through into English to bring new perspectives on what, say from a Western English-based perspective may seem like a certain there's only one, one sort of way of thinking about it. Actually, bringing some of those other opinions in, and even Asia, other parts of the world, bringing those thoughts, that Bitcoin thinking back into English. Is that something Consensus Network is looking at?
Yeah, that's something that I like to talk about a lot. I like to talk about transformation rather than translation. So there's a lot that, like, I don't think anybody can make a serious case that English is not the base layer language of the world. It is very clearly to me. The same way Bitcoin can be the base layer of money in the world, and internet is the base layer of domain. So we are already sort of living in this kind of like a internet village where English is used as the main language. That does not mean that does not obsolete the other languages because they're kind of like layer two or layer three. They're like flavor languages. Like, for example, in my own language, in Finnish, it's very rich in certain kinds of expressions and poetry and the way you can express yourself. It's very different in different languages, and it speaks to your soul because that's what your culture is. So I think that is something very human and very inherent to us based on where we are born, where we were raised. Perhaps that will be less relevant going forward, like 100 and 200 and 1,000 years from now. I don't know. But for now, I would say that transforming the original ideas into the target language as efficiently as possible is the goal. Like explode the, you have, and this is where we go back to the Starfish organization. Because if we would hire a translation agency to do these translations instead of transformations, we won't get as good quality product. Plus it will be expensive. But once we have ideologically driven, like-minded people who absolutely live and breathe Bitcoin, understand Bitcoin, every fiber of their being is to forward the agenda to teach people about Bitcoin, they will understand exactly what the author means, and they can dissect it into atoms and put it together in their own hearts of heart language in the best possible way. So I'm not shy to say that I think that our translations or transformations are at least aimed to be better than the original works for that key audience. Like you, obviously you can't take it back and turn it into any other language. It's just for that specific language, that flavor language that will resonate way better for that target audience. So to me, like the Finnish Bitcoin Standard is the best definitive version of that book, and I stand by that. But of course, it's not accessible except to 6 million people. So the value of that is limited. However, the depth is unlimited.
Yeah, that's really powerful, Nico. I've just been back in Japan for a couple of weeks, and I lived there for many years, and I speak Japanese, and I was working there. And I realized how talking about Bitcoin, you know, just given the political economic structure of the country, there's a lack of the penetration of the Bitcoin kind of thought that we see, kind of English-based, a lot of American-based thought into Japan. And I actually met with the translator of the Bitcoin Standard into Japanese, and I had a good chat with her about what she was trying to do with that project, what it meant, and kind of some of the challenges, kind of knowing from the outside but also from the inside what the challenges are for, I guess, the thought and what Bitcoin means in a society such as Japan, which is a lot more collective than we have in New Zealand. And it was really fascinating to see that. And I was thinking, you know, man, how do you convey that? And even the title, I believe that was it the subtitle of the Bitcoin Standard is the end of central banking. And that particular...
I think it's the decentralized alternative for central banking.
Yeah, sorry. So the decentralized alternative to central banking. But even that phrase, the way it was translated into Japanese, it wasn't as direct as that. And I thought that was really interesting because it's very Japanese to sort of smooth the way and kind of build, in a way, consensus, but without sort of rocking the boat too much. And so that whole cultural nuance was applied to the Japanese translation, and really quite fascinatingly, it was still able to convey that story of Bitcoin through the cultural lens. Because at the end of the day, I think decentralization, I mean, the world is decentralized. We have all these different cultures, all of these different kinds of people, and Bitcoin is for everyone. And so sort of rejecting this idea of a singular Bitcoin culture, which I think is, it might seem like that from the outside, but really there is all these pockets of different kinds of people, you know, different humans, different cultures. And I think that's the beauty of humanity, is we all have different stories, right? And then those can be empowered with Bitcoin and you know, actually enabled to flourish, because we don't have to succumb to this kind of fiat globalism where it's just everything is McDonald's and Starbucks and it kind of sucks. Like, actually we can have culture emerge and independent culture emerge, and we just happen to have this really good money that we can use to interact with each other.
Yeah, that's exactly, Cody, what we did with the Finnish one. The subtitle for the Finnish one is Towards Open Monetary System. Nothing like the original one, right? So yeah, that's a perfect example of what I mean by taking the meaning of the author and rewriting it. It's almost like reauthoring it to some extent, but just that, so that the key elements of the knowledge remain intact. And we went further than that. We actually tweaked the cover. Like, I really like the cover. It's quite iconic already. So we want to leverage the network effect of the Bitcoin standard cover. But we did make some changes for the Finnish version, like we used a squirrel skin instead of a rhizestone, and we used a gold coin instead of gold bars, which are not that well known in Finland. So small stuff like that, but those are all contributing to making it more palatable for the correct audience.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I guess that segues into my next question, which is, how do you work with authors? How do you work with people who maybe have gone through larger publications, have gone through a publishing house and that kind of traditional way of bringing their own book to life? How does the Consensus Network engage with those authors and those organizations to then enable the work that you do?
That's a good question, because I feel like we are able to, because of our organizational structure, we are able to offer much more flexibility than traditional publishing houses while offering the same or better quality of production. So we have a couple of different models that we offer for authors. Nowadays, we also publish original English works. The newest one is Abundance Through Scarcity, which is going to be out in the BTC Prague next week. Really excited about that. So we're moving towards more like original publishers, plus we do all the translations. So what we offer for authors who want to come in-house and work with us is that, look, you are a creative individual. You want to focus on writing about Bitcoin. You probably don't want to focus on, you know, typesetting, cover design, you know, print runs, marketing, all that boring stuff. So we offer the white glove service. So you come in and we take care of all of that. All you have to bring us is your manuscript and the promise that we can publish in certain different languages. So that's what we offer. And the other thing is that we also recognize that self-publishing nowadays with the information age tools, quite easy. I'm not going to lie to anybody and say that, like, you shouldn't go and publish yourself. It's so difficult and you need us. You probably don't. Like, self-publishing is really easy. That's how we started. However, that being said, you still have to do some work. You still have to do the typesetting. You still have to do the cover design. You still have to get the ISBN and marketing and all that. If you're into that, it's manageable. And we offer our services in any which capacity to self-publishers that they need. Maybe they only need cover design. Maybe they only need typesetting or editing. So we can offer help in every step of the way. Whether you want to be one of those white glove authors that lets us take care of everything, or just simple parts of the process. So whatever you need, as long as your book is within our agenda and complies with our editorial guidelines, of course we can't publish just everything, because content curation is our bread and butter. Like, we must make sure that we get out the best content possible within the agenda. So once all those boxes are checked, I mean, we can do anything. We can help with anything, any part of the process.
Are you seeing an emergence or a difference between audiobooks and printed books? Like, is there more of an interest these days in audiobooks?
Yeah, I would say that audiobooks are quite popular nowadays. I would say that they don't really directly compete with paper books. Of course, some people may choose only to get the, myself included, only to get the audiobook of a certain publication and not get the paperback book. But there are still different reading experiences. The same thing as a Kindle book or, you know, an ebook. When I go on traveling, I don't ever bring paper books with me. I bring a Kindle. And if I'm driving or you know, doing my house chores, I might listen to an audiobook. So all those different mediums serve a different purpose. And paper books, as it has, happens to be, has the highest degree of Lindy effect. So it has been around long enough to be around long enough. So I don't think paper books are going to go anywhere anytime soon. They will still continue to provide a different reading experience. You know, you have the tangible book in your hands and you read in the same room from the paper. From the ink, it's a very different experience. That being said, of course, more and more people are, out of convenience, choosing these other mediums. And we also, do audiobooks and we do ebooks. Audiobook production is a little bit slower because we have to find somebody to read it, but that's definitely been worked on.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I'm just trying to remember the name of the project, but there is an open source project around audiobooks for the classic public domain publications. And that's really cool because you can go back and find, 19th century or, earlier works that are in the public domain and listen to them. And it's sort of a volunteer project, maybe a little bit similar to the Starfish model that you described. But that's interesting because I think, the printed books, they still give you that direct relationship. And in a way, it's sort of longer time preference because it slows you down a little bit. You really have to think. You've got the ability to make notes on the page and really engage with the author in that regard. Whereas an audiobook, it's like you kind of just have to listen and you don't. It's a little bit, you're less able to pause it and just dwell on an idea. You kind of, You sort of just go through when you're on your commute or whatnot and listen. So it is, as you say, a different sort of model, and they may not directly compete with each other. But that's
and some books are simply not even suitable for audiobooks. Like one book comes in particular comes to mind. One of my favorites is the Crypto Economics by Eric Voskuil. Try listening to that. It's just simply impossible. It's too condensed. Like you need that time to look at the page, go back, reread, and really process it. It's a very different experience. So some books are not even at all compatible.
Do you think at a broader level, and again, coming at this as an artist and a creative, like I see a lot of work talking about Bitcoin, nonfiction, kind of quite technical work, philosophical work, that sort of thing. But at a higher level, where are we at in terms of a larger movement, which I would describe as sort of the search for authenticity, but in terms of filmmaking, music, just generally creative work, even fiction writing, and informed by this idea of kind of a rejection of fiat and an embracing of proof of work, are you just seeing any murmurs of that emerge at the moment in terms of a larger movement, creative movement around proof of work, Bitcoin thinking, that sort of thing?
Well, it's funny you should mention, I don't know about the larger movement, but I have to mention that we have this project called 21 Futures, which is, I don't know if you check that, but 21futures.com, you can check it. So it's like Bitcoin related short fictional stories that we're going to release as an anthology. And we have a collaboration with Cyberpunk Cinema, another nice account on Twitter that you should definitely check out. They are exactly what you're talking about, like trying to bring this kind of like more creative movement to the mainstream via Bitcoin lens. So Cyberpunk Cinema, they want to do like maybe three of our best stories in a short film format. So I think something like this is sorely needed. If we are ever going to reach so-called general population, they are interested in interesting human interest stories with high stakes, exciting characters, exciting events. They're not going to be interested in the history of money. If you have a book like Bitcoin Standard and you have to read 400 pages of history of money and fiat and all that stuff, let's be honest, it's kind of boring to the most of the people. I recognize that. So I think what we are going to see, and not just our project, but I think in broader term, I think there's more and more people waking up to this realization that we, if we want to break out of our bubble and really reach more people, we have to do it on their terms. Maybe TikTok movies, I don't know anything about that. But reach people where they actually consume content. And I think fiction writing, fiction movies, short movies will be a perfect way to do that. People love science fiction. People love fantasy. And all you have to do is put a little bit of a twist of Bitcoin to plant the seed. So I think that's going to be, it's going to be big.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know about TikTok, but certainly looking at the storytelling mechanism, as I mentioned earlier, the Fountainhead was a really powerful work for me. And that's, you know, a fictional story. It's very humanist in the sense, like, it's human characters that you can identify, but they're archetypal. But at the same time, it's a vehicle for delivering objectivism and this kind of critique of groupthink and communism, effectively, which Ayn Rand was trying to do. And that really struck me a lot more than I think something that was would perhaps be nonfiction, where you're not able to really connect with it. Because as you say, you know, 400 pages about the history of money doesn't quite empower you or inspire you as much as a human story of building up from nothing, building an empire from a vision and a dream, and then achieving that goal. And I think that's where I'm seeing it. Like, you can't yell the message. You have to sort of invite people in, and they curiously come to you, and they ask the questions. And so I guess meeting them where they are, as you say, except for TikTok, but anywhere else they are, go and meet them. And hopefully with that helps inspire, you know, a bit of a tweaking of the way we engage with media as well, because we have this quite centralized approach to media production. And arguably things like Hollywood, they kind of empower this kind of fiat thinking model, which is just quite, even in the last 20 years, it's really quite clear how bad cinema has become as a mechanism for storytelling, because it's so captured. And so maybe we're at the intersection of a couple of things, including like Nostra and decentralized media platforms, which, who knows? I mean, what's the chance that that's going to actually take over at a larger scale? I'm not sure at the moment, but that combined with these kind of stories that have got Bitcoin thinking behind them, but they're actually very human driven stories. So an emerging of those two could be really powerful.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's no way we could ever hope to fix a broken system from within the system, right? Like, there's no way we will infiltrate Hollywood and you know, suddenly have our movies product. Like, that's not going to happen. What could happen, however, is that we build a parallel production scene, and with the, you know, the rise of AI, and now you can make like pretty professional looking movies out of your pocket, basically with your pocket computer. I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see. Like, I think we're going to have a lot of competition, and we, you know, down the line, people want those interesting movies. They want the interesting stories. I don't think they will care if it's from Hollywood. I don't think they will care if it's from India or China or wherever. I mean, maybe some people do. That's politics. But I think there's two things. There's the medium itself, which would be like short stories, movies, you know, fictional writing, whatever. And then there's the forum. And that's why I mentioned TikTok. Like, that's where people are. So like, maybe we can go there. I don't know if that's a good idea. Nostr certainly is an interesting thing, but I don't see that taking off mainstream anytime soon. It will take time. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that with the tools that we have now, we can kind of infiltrate the current forums with better content. And I think that's what we're trying to accomplish with Consensus as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the other idea that I've been exploring as well with my creative business, you know, I do a lot of it's a lot of photography, but I turn those into books and photo books. And my approach since the beginning has been self-publishing and direct to the customer, avoiding things like Amazon. Just, I guess at first it was because it was a pain to try and sign up and work with them. But then over time I realized, well, actually I don't want to work with them, because the medium is the message. And when you sell a book on Amazon, you're part of the Amazon monster. You're kind of feeding it, and you also lose quite a lot of sovereignty over the customer's information. You lose sovereignty over, you know, where it gets shown. You know, I've got my architecture photo book alongside this other random thing, which I didn't, you know, intend it to be alongside that. You know, I'm not in control of that. And so I've been thinking more and more about that sort of over the last couple of months around, well, actually, I'm really happy with where I'm at, because I'm not getting the same exposure that I'd get with Amazon. But at the same time, you know, I'm keeping the profits and I'm in control of my customers' data, and I'm able to package, you know, everything up and really delicately and kind of in a very, I was going to say a Japanese word for this, but you know, that like there's this way, like this relationship with the customer, which I really respect and I'm thankful for. And if it's just getting shipped out from a warehouse somewhere through the Amazon AI, you know, slave wage system that they've got going, I don't want to be part of that. And that search for authenticity, my customers are actually really happy to be part of that and to pay for that. You know, they don't, you know, it's a $20 book or is it a $50 book? Because the difference, actually, that they're happy to pay the higher amount if it means that they're getting an authentic experience. And I don't quite have the full description of this, but this is an idea that I'm sort of exploring at the moment. And I feel like it's kind of independently being sought after, I guess, the search for authenticity, maybe.
Yeah, I guess we go back to proof of work maximalism. Like, there's no denying that Amazon has the top of the line supply chain in the world at the moment. Like, you couldn't possibly compete with them with volumes or reach or anything really, which sucks. And their service in many ways sucks. And like you said, you don't own your content, you don't own your revenue, you're dependent on them. They can deplatform you. Happened to us once already. We got back on. So I wouldn't rely on those. That being said, they also account for about 50% of our sales still, the fiat sales, of course. So as a revenue-funded startup, we can't really walk away from that. So we're threading kind of like the line between not selling fully out and taking advantage of their existing network while simultaneously building our own meat-based distribution network, which is something that I'm really passionate about and something that goes way beyond books that we sorely need. Like, if you ever try to send anything even inside Europe or let alone from Europe to another country or anything cross Atlantic, is a nightmare with the customs and everything. So there should be a better way to do those, and nobody has really cracked on that because Amazon owns all of those channels. So it's kind of like a game of attrition the way I see it. Well, keeping one foot in the pool that we can draw a little bit of revenue while we build something that will eventually hopefully obsolete them.
What's your, do you have a Bitcoin, a market where a Bitcoin can be used to purchase your books? Like how does that work for you guys?
Yeah, of course. I mean, from day one, like even before we went with Amazon, we already had our own shop. It's consensus.network. And nowadays we have bitcoinbook.shop, which is maybe a little bit more easy to remember and easy to share. So maybe use that one. And yeah, you can, you've been able to buy in Bitcoin since 2019 from the very first days. First, we used the open node, which is a custodian service, but now we have self-hosted BTC Pay server, which I'm really proud of. Works really well. Best customer experience, in my opinion, of paying a book. But yeah, I mean, we're not Amazon. Like, we're not trying to be. We're not pretending to be. We're just doing something slightly more different. So we have these different, like, smaller entrepreneurs in different countries. Like, we have one in Germany, Copiaro. Ronnie there is doing awesome job. Another Bitcoiner. You should definitely support him. He's also doing distribution work for other Bitcoin companies. So I think what we're going to see is more and more of these small scale operators locally that will be able to plug in to these self-hosted e-commerce sites that sell physical goods. Like, the crux is selling physical goods. It's the meat-based distribution network that is pretty much shot and pretty much monopolized by Amazon and the likes. So it's kind of difficult to push through there. Our shipping costs are obviously non-comparable to Amazon. We can never compete with them. But on the other hand, our customers are pretty understanding. They want to pay in Bitcoin. They want to support the Bitcoin companies, which I appreciate. So I guess we'll just keep threading that line between having one foot in the fiat world, which we still need for licensing reasons, and, you know, operating a business in the fiat world and in the meat-based distribution network while trying to build something that will eventually replace it.
Yeah. That's fascinating. That's probably a good point for us to jump out, Nico. But I'm just wondering, you've got the website consensus.network, and that's consensus with a K. Is there anywhere else you'd like to send the listeners to learn more about what you do or to connect with you?
Yeah, sure. Definitely follow Consensus Twitter. It's Consensus N. And if you want to follow me personally, I'm OmniFin with a double N on Twitter. Apart from that, yeah, Bitcoinbook.shop is the one that you want to give to people who want to buy the latest, best original works as well as the translations. So we are more and more profiling as also original publishers. And not only translations, even though translations is where we started, and that's always going to be our specialization. But realistically, we want to be the first ones in first and the last ones out. So we'll get the original work in and we'll translate it in every single language.
Yeah. Hey, that's absolutely incredible, and I appreciate the work you're doing. It's really important, and as I said, I think there's a lot of beautiful perspectives from all over the world, and being able to not just translate but transform that, as you say. I mean, this podcast is the transformation of value, and I think that's really the key word that I'm seeing emerging in a lot of my conversations, is the transformational power of Bitcoin. But hey, Nico, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. And all the best with BTC Prague. You're going to be there?
Yeah, I'm going to
Yeah.
be there.
Nice, man. Appreciate it. Well, look, we'll catch up, hopefully catch up again at some point in the future. I think there's a lot more to unpack. And I think we would love to see the success of the Consensus Network.
Thanks a lot for inviting me, Cody.
No, thank
Appreciate
you.
it.
Okay. See you later. Bye.
Take care.